Disinformation continues to be a threat to Ukrainian sovereignty and is also targeted at Western democracies and allies of Ukraine. Around the world, aggressive information warfare threatens information security as well as social stability, especially in those states which Russia seeks to destabilize or coerce into supporting it. As we saw in the 2016 US election, it can potentially threaten the results of voting, place undue influence on voters' decisions, and undermine democratic processes. We've also seen propaganda narratives used with great effect to delay aid to Ukraine over the last 6 months as well. Tackling weaponized propaganda is more important than ever, with a slew of elections set to take place through 2024. And of course, if we look into the near future, the advent of exponentially increasing fakes created by AI. Welcome to the Silicon Curtain podcast. Please like and subscribe and definitely comment on the videos if you like our guest speakers. Please do also check out the validated Ukrainian charities that appear in the description of the video. Many of them are involved in helping servicemen who have helped Ukraine to stay resilient and free, and they now deserve and need our support. Stas Olinchenko is a content strategist and writer focused on Ukraine, media, and tech. He is the writer behind the Words War newsletter, which focuses on undoing myths about Ukraine. And today we are going to tackle many of those myths and, of course, the weaponized historical myths that Russia creates in order to support its internal and external propaganda. Stas, welcome to the channel.
Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for having me. And yeah, I'd like to start by again saying that, thank you for all that you're doing. I think your channel is becoming this huge library of insights. So thank you. Thank you for that.
I think it is important. And perhaps when I started the project, I didn't quite realize really that there was so much to cover and how important these topics are. But I think it's becoming clearer to a lot more people. And the trouble, though, is no matter how many videos I produce, there are always more examples of Russian messaging that somehow gets into the media, gets into the academic bloodstream of dialogue, and also, unfortunately, informs foreign policy discussions and decisions. And I think we both decided that we're going to start this off by talking about an article produced by Sergei Radchenko and Samuel Charop on the Istanbul talks. And what really got me about this, I'll sort of let you do majority of talking, but what really got me about this article was the normalization and the whitewashing, and one could even say the weaponization of Russian narratives around the idea that somehow it is a credible negotiation partner. But could you give us a bit of a breakdown of the article and why you think it's so dangerous?
Yeah, absolutely. Like all of the things that you say are valid. I think it's we can only speculate about the intentions of Radchenko and Charop, but it's clear that they have an agenda, and it's clear that they wrap all this, you know, intellectual talk in actually, you know, Russian narratives that are produced in Russia and exported in Russia. For instance, like this whole idea that the Istanbul negotiations in 2022, there were genuine negotiations that could have led to a true peace that would be beneficial for Ukraine, for democracy in the world, it's just not real. It never was real. And this has been from the start this narrative that was pushed by Russian propagandists, paid or just useful idiots, precisely to kind of distort our idea of what happened in spring of 2022, who is to blame, and like what the lessons from these talks are. And yeah, I think one of the most like toxic ideas that that they kind of touch upon. Again, like the most dangerous part of their article is that they're not Kremlin propagandists, like in the genuine sense. They're not people who you see, read, and you realize, oh, okay, they're just like pro-Putin, hawks. They're not. But the kind of wording that they choose, the kind of angles that they choose to pursue is very telling, I think. One of them being is that, if we start from the basics, the Istanbul talks, they were nothing more than Russia trying to make Ukraine capitulate in like a legal way and internationally, in a way that would seem legitimate in the eyes of international law. You know, we have an agreement, it's signed by both Ukraine and Russia, so let's just move on. And this attempt failed just because Ukraine managed to resist successfully, and because Ukraine's Western partners managed to kind of get their act together and started to actually help Ukraine with weapons that made a difference on the front line. And so Ukraine was not pushed anymore to accept this total defeat and sign this agreement. Again, which was not finalized, but it was going in that direction. Basically, if it succeeded, and again, the whole idea of capitulation agreement succeeding by an invaded state just like accepting the invaders is just insane. Like, what's the success rate here? So, if we start trying to look for more explanations of what happened there, why it happened, it's okay to kind of dig into it, but it's also important to always have this perspective on this event, like what it actually was, what these talks were about. And Charap and Radchenko, I think they distort this general view of these talks. They try to hint that, well, maybe this was a genuine negotiations attempt. Maybe there was some kind of peace that we all lost for some reason. Part of it is maybe the West to blame. Part of it may be Ukraine. Part of it, of course, Russia.
And that dilutes culpability, doesn't it? That's saying, the invasion was wrong, but actually poor Russia is partly the victim of this, because they had some good intention there, some genuine intention, and they proposed a realistic solution to the war. And that dovetails, doesn't it, with the idea that, well, NATO provoked it. And if you think NATO provoked it, which of course is nonsense, and if you think that Russia tried to negotiate in good faith, then somehow you're diluting what actually happened. But you mentioned Charap's normalization of what essentially was not a genuine process. It was a rubber stamp to try and give some, credibility or international credibility on what was an entirely illegal war. But Charap also wrote an article around the time, I think it was, of that negotiation, if not, I need to check the dates on that, because around this time, he wrote an article saying that Western weapons wouldn't make any difference on the battlefield at all. So you can see a sort of pattern emerging there of diminishing the idea of resistance against Russia as something that is credible, and also trying to put, I would say, more validity on that process than it actually had.
Yeah, definitely. I think the article you're talking about, I think he published it even earlier. I think it was like January or February 2022, but like it was right before Russia invaded. So he made a point like trying to say that, don't even consider sending weapons to Ukraine. It will not like make any difference. So let's just, not even talk about it. So it already like shows his beliefs, I guess you can call them, his agenda. And I think in summer of, I actually don't remember, maybe it was 22 or maybe it was already 2023, but he also wrote an article, I think it was named something like The Case for Negotiating with Russia. Again, like we've seen at that point, Russia has been, you know, still trying to conquer all of Ukraine for more than a year. And there has been no proof, no empirical evidence of Russia being open to any negotiations or respecting any other agreements that it had about Ukraine and with Ukraine. I think it's about the timing of these articles and also the intention, the main intention. Like, why would you write these materials? What's your goal? What do you, like, who do you want to persuade? And what do you want to, you know, what's your message that you're conveying? And Cherub has been terrible on all of these aspects since before the invasion, I think.
And there's three options, aren't there? And we're going to deconstruct some of these. You've sent me a really interesting sort of thesis about the sort of I would say sort of the deep level and the sort of shallow level of Russian propaganda, and also the differences between internal and external. But if we look at Charup, there are three assumptions we can make here. Either he is epically wrong about everything and just, he's just wrong, but continues to be published despite his epic wrongness, and
and promoted. I think he recently was promoted. So
fail upwards, I think, is the phrase there. So if we're going to be the most charitable, he's just epically bad at analyzing stuff and predicting it, and yet, as you say, gets a big platform for that. So that's the most charitable explanation. The next explanation is that somehow people like him are paid or have compromat on them, and we have no evidence at all. So we're not sued. We have no evidence at all that that is the case. He was, however, I believe, a member of Valdai, which is the Valdai Discussion Group, and not everyone who is part of that forum has necessarily gone on to be problematic, but some clearly have. And if you spend a lot of your time, I would say, in Russia, in those circles, well, I mean, the chances are you will be at least approached by some kind of intelligence service. I mean, I rather suspect as students, the same thing happened to us, and we were nobody with no influence whatsoever. So it's quite a good assumption there. The third is that there may be some other reasons that are very difficult to divine, but that these people know exactly what they're doing. They know that they're wrong, but they're putting forward these points of view for a strategic purpose. Well, before we move on to the next topic, I think it's important to analyze the strategic purpose behind all propaganda narratives, because they're not just put out there for the fun of it. It's an expensive process of crafting, distributing, and then amplifying propaganda narratives. So you don't do that unless you have some purpose, just like you don't invest in advertising unless you have a product to sell. I mean, it's a similar kind of principle there. So what could be the benefit at this point of trying to create the impression that Russia is a credible negotiating partner?
Yeah, before that, I just wanted to say that I think Charup is, I mean, it's just one person, but he's very symptomatic of the approach that Russia has to spreading its narratives. And I think it's like his case is just one case in a wider pattern, in a wider picture. And I think a lot of people in the West kind of refuse to see this picture, because for them, this is like a, you know, Cold War type of story. You know, everybody is a spy. Everybody has an agenda. There's a lot of covert, you know, actors. And I think a lot of people see it as kind of this, almost a joke, an outdated joke. And what many of these people fail to understand is that Russia has not moved on from these methods. And if anything, they have only improved how they work with informational warfare with the narratives, basically. So yeah, and about the thing that you said, the question about the end goal. Well, again, we can only speculate, and a lot of things that happen on the front line in Ukraine will determine what's the political process is going to be. But it's obvious that Russia is, I think it is trying to prepare Western audience to this idea that maybe a bad peace deal is still better than this, you know, forever war, which is, again, is not true. Like, for almost anybody living in a democracy, a bad peace deal in Ukraine, well, it wouldn't be even a peace deal. I think it would just mean, you know, a ceasefire until Russia feels comfortable to reinvade Ukraine. But this kind of deal would be catastrophic for, you know, security of people living in democracies. And it would basically put in question everything that has been done to support Ukraine and its resistance for more than 2 years. And I think Russia is right now, like, working towards this, creating this fundament to, I think, to help to make a Western audience kind of play with this idea that, you know, maybe it's not as impossible as we were told. Maybe Russia can be trusted, at least at some point. And maybe, you know, all this dying is much worse than whatever, like, however bad this deal would be. So yeah, that's, again, that's just speculation, but I think that's the direction they're aiming at.
And there's another example, I think, if you look at the Minsk Accords, which, again, there are quite a few Russian commentators who and propagandists who laugh at the idea that you know, the Minsk Accords were genuine. You know, they were a strategic ploy by Russia to prevent Western countries from supporting Ukraine, providing armaments, and of course they could use those pseudo negotiations, they are, but if you provide you know, lethal weaponry, then these negotiations can't happen and you're going to jeopardize and destroy the process. So it's entirely possible that they fear a new avalanche of Western weapons late, of course, provided incrementally far later than they should be, when Ukraine needed them. Nonetheless, there is about to be, I think, a deluge of new weapons and capabilities targeted towards Ukraine. Maybe this is an attempt to try and put some validity on past negotiations and then threaten and say, but if you do this, then these sort of, you know, we can't negotiate with you if you do this. You'll have destroyed any chances of peace, not us. Again, it's a sort of projected victimhood kind of strategy.
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's important to realize also that they're not pursuing just one narrative at a time. It's not that they have chosen this kind of negotiations, you know, narrative and they're, like, doubling down just on it. They're at the same time spreading many other, you know, ideas and narratives and just lies. Some of them may be controversial. Some of them may not even, you know, create a consistent worldview, but their aim is the same. Like, they undermine the West's support to Ukraine, and they try to stop or delay the sending of weapons to Ukraine. Like, just a couple of days ago, I think there was a hearing in the Congress, and Marjorie Taylor Greene, she went to present Professor Timothy Snyder, who is a, you know, one of the most respected experts on Ukraine and the history of our region in the US. So she presented him with these, like, facts that, you know, there are Nazi people in Ukraine. So I guess this means, like, US should just stop supporting Ukraine, which is a very old, you know, propaganda. It has been, you know, I think it was, like, the most popular narrative that Russia pursued in 2014, when it started its aggression against Ukraine. But then I think since 2022, this narrative has gotten more, like it was pushed to the fringes because it became much more evident and apparent that it was just not true. And whatever Russia was doing, it was not because it was afraid of far-right movements in Ukraine. So I think all of these, but we just have to remember that there are many narratives that Russia pushes onto us at the same time, and they may not even seem intertwined, but they all have a shared goal. Mm. And it's much easier for a narrative to be effective if your goal is very, you know, aggressive and harmful, if you don't try to create something, if you don't try to strengthen the alliance, but you try to destroy it and you try to spread hate, it's just much more potent, you know, emotion to amplify. Yeah.
And of course, in your sort of breakdown that you shared with me, you point out, and I think this is very important, that Russian propaganda is much more complicated than people realize. Of course, you might sit there as an intelligent person and say, well, actually, I can see Russian propaganda coming. It's obvious. I can hear the narratives. I can spot them. But actually, when you're fine-tuned into this, you realize that it actually exists at multiple layers. You might spot certain layers of it, but other layers are far more insidious and will percolate through to many people, even those who think they're immune to it. So what's your understanding of this multi-layered complexity to the propaganda?
Yeah. So as I said, I think it, like looking at it through layers is the most helpful way to study Russian narratives and Russian propaganda, because a lot of people assume when they hear Russian propaganda, they assume it's this, you know, deranged talk show by Vladimir Solovyov, or, you know, Dmitry Medvedev just like tweeting or posting some absolute, you know, just batshit crazy stuff. But this is just, you know, a part of what they're doing. This is the external layer. This is also part of it is internal propaganda. So it has other audience. And it's just partly directed at Western audiences. But there are, you know, layers and layers and layers. And the deeper you go, the less obvious it becomes whether you're reading just a genuine piece of, you know, journalistic work or, you know, a policy report or whatever. Or is it actually something that has been produced and curated and or maybe like whitewashed by the Kremlin? So I think we started from Cherub, but I think it's kind of one of the least obvious layers there are, because I would say that it is one of the deepest levels of Russian narratives sort of penetrating Western discussions. Because again, these people are well-established experts. The White House, you know, listens to them, or at least recognizes them as experts. And these people don't necessarily say that Ukraine is, you know, doing something wrong or that the West is wrong. They don't say that Russia's invasion is justified. So, like, it's much harder for somebody who is outside of this Russian narrative bubble to read it and instantly spot that something's wrong, you know, something's fishy. But between Solovyov and Sharp, I think there's a whole lot of layers with that are intended to target different audiences, that are intended to spur, like, that have different levels of complexity, basically. It can be something wild, or it can be a, you know, stupid post on social media, but it also can be a pretty, you know, long deep dive in a respectable journal. And yeah, so I think the
Go ahead.
No, I just wanted to say that I think the best way for us to kind of spot it is to learn learn to read these texts efficiently and learn to spot these wordings, these kind of constructions, these maybe biases that are expressed in text. And if we do spot them, then maybe we should, you know, take a look at who wrote it, why they wrote it, and so on. But I think the evidence is usually in the text that we're, you know, analyzing and reading.
And that's I'd like to dig into that, because I mean, you and I, on a professional basis, sort of do this all the time: the deconstruction of texts, the parsing, the semantic parsing of texts to try and find out patterns. And of course, one of the key parts of marketing, as well as it had to be say, you have to say as well, is religious texts as well. One of the key tricks to get people to absorb an idea, to internalize that idea, is also repetition. And that repetition may use different terminology, different formulations, but it's the repetition of an idea. How does Russian propaganda use this? And how does it create what has been called the polyphony, which is to present that idea back to you through multiple voices, multiple personas, multiple platforms, to the point where it starts to seem like an organic rather than a manufactured idea to the audience?
Yeah, I think you're completely right. It is about repetition, and it is about repetition of the same sort of ideas and narratives, but through different channels, through different people. And you know, this whole idea is to gradually cover as many institutions and people who are you know, from deranged lunatics to respectable institutions, to create sort of illusion that this is an organic idea, this is an organic discussion that we're having, that we're not made to talk about Ukrainian Nazis. You know, it's a genuine concern that we're all having. Yeah, I think one of the most dangerous aspects of this work is that most of the times we just don't know if a person is just a useful idiot, or are they on a payroll, and maybe they have a connection to the Kremlin. Maybe they're even, you know, they're just spies or connected to Russian special operations. And so if we go around and just point to all these people who seem to have pro-Russian biases, and start shouting, you know, you're all Russian agents, then we risk to be seen as these crazy people who are obsessed. So this sort of like distortion of who's saying what and why, and this is one of the most dangerous aspects of this network of propaganda spreaders, because at some point, and I think we've reached this point, you just see a lot of discussions that seem genuine, that have genuine supporters, even of like among people living in democracies, but these discussions have been manufactured artificially in Moscow or by Moscow. So like at this point, in some of these cases, it's just too late for us to you know, stop them from spreading. We can just, I think the best thing that we can do is untangle them and try to understand, okay, like how do we just shut this discussion down, because this is not a genuine discussion that we're having.
And one of the strongest narratives is not necessarily that Russia is correct and Russia is right, although I know that is used on, say, the evangelical community in the US. The idea of Russia being moral and somehow superior works in certain communities, but it's got a limited scope. The idea that is then used in people who may understand that Russia is not a sort of noble and you know, benefit to those countries and territories it conquers, they use the argument that yes, of course Russia's bad, but it's also invincible and it's eternal and you stand no chance. This seems to be a narrative that is used across the spectrum from the useful idiots to those who are, you know, right at the extremes of narratives, all the way through to those who are considered, I would say, reputable foreign policy experts, inverted commas.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Russia doesn't need to convince everybody that it's right, that it is the force for good in the world. But what it's enough for Russia just to make sure everybody thinks that, you know, there is no right side here. There is no, you know, morally correct side here. Everybody's on their own. Everybody's pursuing their agendas. And, you know, basically this is a sort of nihilism that they try to spread, especially among the people living in democracies, because for them, this means that, you know, people will stop believing that democracy is in any way better than, you know, dictatorships or totalitarian states or fascist states. And that is how Russia becomes stronger in international on the international scene, because, you know, if there's no strong pro-democratic alliance against Russia, and currently we're talking about Ukraine, so like this is the main sort of literal battlefield of this struggle. If you don't have a strong sense of you know, unity among people defending democracy, then it's just much easier for dictatorships to corner each state at once, take them at once, expose their vulnerabilities, and work them through, you know, one by one. Yeah, so that's what I think they're doing. It's a very, that's actually something that I've written about recently, that it feels increasingly similar to tackling fossil fuel propaganda, because oil corporations, they often don't need to, like, they don't need to convince people that, you know, oil is superb, nothing's wrong with oil, let's just, you know, yeah, so like they don't need to make this argument to succeed. What they should be doing, and they're doing, is try to convince people that all this green agenda is just as bad as oil. Nobody is right. We shouldn't change anything, by the way, in our economy. Let's just move on. Let's just, you know, accept things as they are. And yeah, it's very similar to what Russia is doing. And part of the reason is that Russia has been one of the architects of fossil fuel propaganda as well.
That's right. And, you know, this may trigger a few people in the audience, but there is evidence pointing towards the weaponization narratives during the COVID pandemic as well, originating from Russia. Now, of course, that's not to say all of it came from Russia. It's not to say that there aren't genuine concerns there, but certainly, you know, Russian methods, there's fingerprints on some of the weaponization of conspiracy theories that we saw there. And I think that's an interesting one to pick up on, because we've been talking about the more, I won't say rational, because we know that they can be factually disproved, but we have been talking about the more sort of rational ways of arguing in propaganda. One would assume to convince people who can fact check, who can potentially think about the information they've been feeding. But a key part, actually, of Russian propaganda, both internally and externally, has been to weaponize conspiracy theories. And those would seem to be absurd to many people who sit outside of those. And historical mythology, which, again, to those who are not exposed to it, let's say, from childhood and so on, would also seem to be utterly absurd. So what, in your view, is the role of weaponized historical mythology and conspiracy theory within the Russian methodology?
Well, I think they're very potent in a way that it's just very hard to disprove them. to and you know fact checking against propaganda, it's just it doesn't work. It doesn't really work. Like there is a very limited you know success that you can reach by taking all of these narratives, all of these claims made by propagandists, and you know fact check them and rationally explain to people why they're wrong and what's like the actual data that we have. This just doesn't work. And yeah, so like the only way you can tackle these sort of narratives is you have to shut down these discussions entirely, or you have to deplatform people who are hijacking these discussions. And this is extremely hard, especially in democracies where there's such thing as freedom of speech. So I think Russia is abusing this feature of democracy to just hijack our discussions and install all these multiple conspiracies and revisionist myths. And just because, you know, again, if you repeat all these lies in and pack them in different forms and keep throwing them at different communities online and offline, they will start, you know, sticking in. They will start to have an impact after some time and after you spend some money. And it's, you know, we've seen in the last 10 years that it's extremely hard to tackle these basically information warfare methods using, you know, standard democratic procedures and methods. That's I think why Russia has been so effective at it.
The next area to focus on, I think, is give me 2 seconds just to think. So one interesting point you made, and I really, you know, struggled with this at the time when the article came out, and that is some of these deeper level, more slightly more subliminal Russian narratives. And one you point out, I think, which is really interesting, is the controversy, the manufactured controversies around Volodymyr Zelensky. And when you see articles about that, including the one in Harper's Magazine earlier last year about the tragedy of Volodymyr Zelensky, and I think there was another big piece in Time as well, they do seem to create the impression of victimhood, I think, is one. And these aren't qualities actually I associate with Zelensky or his speeches or his rise to fame and fortune. It's the opposite of victimhood, but many of these articles do seem to warp or change the perception of Zelensky, and one wonders what the point of that is. So you've been following these. What do you think is the mechanics behind these kind of articles? Why do they get published, and how do they potentially influence people in a way that is advantageous to the Kremlin?
Yeah, that article in the Harper's, I think it's a very clear example of these deeper layers, because the entire article, it seems to be coming from a, you know, a good place, a genuine place of empathy. At least you kind of get this read when you read the first paragraph. The author, he's like, he recognizes, you know, Russian invasion of Ukraine as this violent thing, and he talks about Ukraine's resistance and how Zelensky has been compared to Churchill since then. So it kind of starts from this empathetic point of view. And I think that's where it draws in all the people who are, again, empathetic to Ukraine, but not necessarily very informed about everything that's been happening, especially before 2022. And then like this article gently like pushes these people to suddenly, you know, claim that there was a civil war in Ukraine since 2014. And that, you know, there were these rebel separatists that just wanted to break away from Ukraine, of course, like with some Russian support, but like he actually uses the term civil war at some point in the article. And of course, then like he concludes with all this idea that the West is also a very much a party to blame in all of this war. So I think the dangerous aspect of this is that it works with actually empathetic people, people who are not deranged, who are not necessarily the usual audience of Russian propaganda narratives, who maybe, you know, follow in some news, who maybe want to know more. And it creates a sort of mess in their head because, again, it throws in some of these narratives. It mixes them up with actually true account of events. And basically, it makes all these people to question whether Ukraine is right in this conflict, whether, you know, the West is right in arming Ukraine, and so on and so forth. And now, I don't know why publications like Harper's Magazines and others want to publish these sort of articles, because once they do publish them, usually there's a backlash from Ukrainians, from Ukraine supporters, and usually from people who know a thing or two about Eastern Europe, Russia, and Ukraine. So there's always this backlash, and there's always this discussion of like, how the hell this was actually published. There's so many manipulations. There's so many issues with this thing. And, you know, unfortunately, I don't have the answer to this question. I wonder about these things myself. I don't know the mechanics within these institutions, these magazines, but it's clear that something about their structure makes them vulnerable for this sort of more complicated Russian propaganda to creep in, because, you know, it is a pattern that gets repeated over and over again.
Well, let's pick another one. And this is, you know, when we were going to discuss this, and I've been looking at some of his articles for a while now, and this is Simon Jenkins, who is a very senior journalist within the UK. He has been an editor on some of the leading newspapers and publications. And I just had him down as a little bit of a, how do you call it? It's a Russophile. Someone whose thinking is influenced by. But now I look through his headlines over the last couple of years. It's an extraordinary array of Russian appeasing messages here. And, you know, we've got an article in 2017 arguing that Trump should get closer to Russia, and it's a good thing. After Litvinenko was assassinated, he writes an article saying that further sanctions against Russia would be pointless and hypocritical. Extraordinarily appeasing statement there. He's written numerous articles in 2022 about how sanctions against Russia are backfiring, they're not working, etc. All the evidence is to the contrary, that actually sanctions have had an effect and are having an effect, not as much as one would hope, but cancelling sanctions, it's pretty obvious, would simply bolster Russia's war machine rather than limit it. So absolutely absurd kind of points of view here. Article about the cancellation of Russian culture being Kafkaesque, which is extraordinary in the context of how Russia weaponizes culture. I'm talking a lot, but I think it's important people see some of these. They are extraordinary. He's arguing not to support Taiwan and let it to the mercy of China. He's arguing here that it's fine to cleanse dirty Russian money from the City of London, but it won't make any difference. So extraordinary series of articles that essentially argue for inaction. And I think that's one of the very powerful methodologies, isn't it, of Russian propaganda, is this one which you mentioned earlier, which is you might as well not do anything because it won't make any difference. And we're hypocrites anyway, so who are we to do anything or say anything? You know, we're all as bad as each other. These are classic Russian disinformation techniques. So as I look through these headlines, I become more and more suspicious of this writer, that this is not accidental, that there is methodology here. Further articles that arm that argue that Britain should not rearm, and articles that talk about diplomacy, and as we started this conversation, that seek to show that diplomacy is the only way forward, whereas I think just about anyone in Ukraine will tell you that negotiations with Russia are neither plausible nor credible. And the last article, I will stop talking now, the last article here is accusing NATO of being reckless over Ukraine, again, trying to argue for inaction and leaving Ukraine to its fate. And in some ways, it almost implies that NATO is the problem and not Russia. So I know you've followed some of his articles as well. What are your thoughts there on the pattern of the kind of emotions and inaction that this writer seems to be trying to induce in his audience?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Inaction is like the main word, like how we can describe all this strategy. Because again, I think Russia doesn't need to, convince everybody to support Russia with actions. It's just enough for Russia to make a lot of people, be very passive and not act on injustice. And I think this is exactly the case. You're absolutely right. Like when you see a pattern of this sort of messaging, when you see that there's a pattern of always, criticizing Western policy towards Russia or China, and always with this angle of sort of we need to just abandon these regions, just like not interfere. We have to go easy. Basically, just let's just do nothing and hope for the better. I mean, again, as we talked, I think it's this layered approach. Some of these narratives are more direct and call for specific action, and some of them just spread nihilism and idea that nothing can be done or nothing should be done. And that is perfect for Russia, because again, if arms to Ukraine are delayed or if they're stopped, that's just enough for Russia to basically conquer Ukraine and win the war. Inaction is a win for them. And about Jenkins, like personally, I honestly don't know, like I haven't followed his like entirety of his career. I don't know what he wrote before that. I started noticing his agenda, I think starting with 2022, because I saw his articles on The Guardian and I saw that he's consistently criticizing the West, but for all the wrong reasons. Let's make the sanctions weaker. Let's stop supporting Ukraine militarily. Let's altogether, abandon this, idea that we have to interfere. This is like, again, if we start walking around pointing at people and saying they're Russian agents, this is just counterproductive. But when you see these patterns, you have to question, the integrity of the writer. And the goal of their work, like what's their goal? What's their solution that they're trying to promote?
And it will be interesting. I fervently believe that Russia will eventually undergo a catastrophic defeat in its offensive war. It may not happen soon or quickly enough, but it will be interesting to see what kind of articles these people produce when the evidence is there, when the evidence is uncovered, and when it's demonstrated that Western arms and Ukrainian skill and determination can actually triumph over Russia, and when it becomes absolutely clear what kind of an entity it is, I fear that they will just turn around and find another angle. because propaganda always pivots and finds another way to package up its sort of lies and influence. But I'll give you the final word before I say thank you.
I totally agree with you. I think all these people, all these institutions, they will find another angle. They will find another revisionist angle. They will, as some time passes, they will try to see what was wrong with our policy anyway, how, you know, we could have avoided all of this. Basically, everything that we see, you know, all these pro-Russian voices saying about post-Cold War order, saying that, you know, well, the West didn't treat Russia with respect, NATO enlarged, and so, like, here's why we're having these sort of wars in the region. I think it's going to be all the same. They will find an angle to blame the West and portray Russia as the victim. That's their job, you know. And overall, again, I think it's super important to not just to talk about every piece that we read, because otherwise it becomes all, you know, the noise on Twitter is just insane, and the discussion is often not very productive. But I think it's very important to sort of step back and see the patterns where they are, and see what kind of ideas are pushed by certain actors and thinkers. And make our conclusions and try to figure out, okay, like, what can we do about it? Because it clearly is a problem, and not just about Ukraine, not just about Russia, but about, you know, the resilience of democracies in general.
Well, Stas, that's an incredibly powerful place to end and a very important thought to take away. Thanks so much for spending time on a Saturday evening talking to me. It's been incredibly instructive, and we'll put a link to to your blog there and to your social media post, and I strongly encourage people to check those out. But thanks so much for coming on the channel.
Thanks, Jonathan. Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.